Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The reception to former President Zelensky's so-called victory plan has been tepid, and that is being generous. The fatal flaw of the plan is twofold. It doesn't focus on peace or security. At the end of the day, these forced errors are the fault of Washington and NATO. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Peter Kuznick in Washington. He is a professor of history at American University, as well as co-author with Oliver Stone, The Untold History of the United States. Also in Washington, we have Matthew Crosston. He is a professor of national security and director of academic transformation at Bowie State University. And in Bangkok, we cross to Angelo Giuliano. He is a political and financial analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Peter, if I can go to you first in Washington, as I said in my introduction, I mean, the reception to the so-called victory plan was quite tepid, even among its his strongest supporters, meaning former President Zelensky. But how would you assess what I said in my introduction? I said the fatal flaws, it doesn't talk about peace, it doesn't talk about security.
I think that the plan was dead on arrival, that Zelensky was delusional in thinking he was going to get a better response, and that it has other fatal flaws also, in addition to the ones you highlight. Number one, it involves Ukraine joining NATO, and NATO has no appetite for Ukraine joining at this point. And secondly, it involves giving Ukraine permission to use long-range missiles from the United States, Britain, and others to strike inside of Russia. Very deep inside of Russia, and Putin has made very clear that that crosses a red line that he's not going to ignore this time and likely respond with nuclear weapons, or is at least implying that that's possible. And so even Biden, as obtuse as he's been throughout this whole thing, even Biden has refused to give permission. We know that in the United States, Blinken and Sullivan appear to be supporting Zelensky in getting access to those long-range missiles, but Austin and the Pentagon have been resisting. And so neither of those conditions is going to fly with the United States or other Western powers at this point. So the plan is not viable in any way.
Well, Matthew, was this kind of just intentional? I mean, there's no prospect for a victory for Ukraine in this conflict. So you could kind of flip it around. Okay, if victory is illusory, just keep it going. I mean, it's a conflict for conflict's sake now.
Well, that's absolutely true, and something we've spoken about before in the past. I just want to add to Peter's fine points as well. I was fascinated watching the aftermath of the speech, where you actually had some members of the Ukrainian parliament who were there live for the speech listening, and they actually made comments of, well, to paraphrase, they're saying basically they almost became like political satirists on the fly, because they said, I'm somewhat surprised at how much the Ukrainian victory plan isn't really all that Ukrainian. There's not much Ukraine in the Ukrainian victory plan. And is it really a plan as much as a sort of Ukrainian leadership regime Christmas wish list, given the season we're coming into, because our plan is we need to get new tactics and new deterrent strategies and new weapon systems and new economic development plans and new statuses on the global stage and new membership in international organizations. So is this really a plan that is meant to end the war, or is it meant to prop up an existing regime while the war continues on indefinitely?
Yeah, Angelo, there seems to be an interesting cause and effect relationship here. Every time Zelensky goes to the United States, he leaves with some cash. I mean, is the victory plan really planning his next trip while the current administration is in power? Because it kind of looks like the latter stage. I mean, you know, we need cash, we need help, you know, okay, here, you know, stuff it in your back pocket here on your way. Because that's the way it looked like he was treated in the last trip to the United States. Angelo, in Bangkok.
Well, his trip, again, this is another distraction. Zelensky is losing relevance. Nobody is talking about Ukraine anymore, and he's desperate for attention. Now we see the world attention is shifting towards the Middle East. This is much more serious, and the ultimate war, actually, for the U.S. is China. So the U.S. has already shifted towards China, and it's busy with the Middle East. Now, what the collective West needs to do is to build up a narrative because they're losing face. And I think this is, we are at an inflection moment. And I think when we look back at, in history, the inflection moment was Ukraine. So in reality, much bigger things are happening right now. In Kazan, the BRICS are happening. This is going to reshape the world. Now, Ukraine is a small detail. The war has been lost. It was not Ukraine, by the way. It was NATO that lost. And they will need to build up a narrative to say, well, somehow, well, we didn't lose. They might say, well, Russia won, at what cost? They will need to find a narrative.
Well, so I already came up with the slogan. Putin didn't make it to Paris. We won. Okay, that's what essentially that's what it's going to be. Peter, let me go back to you on a much more serious note and something you have an expertise in. We had Zelensky in the last few news cycles mention demands NATO or nukes. I mean, is this a sign of desperation? I mean, this is quite terrifying. Anytime, and unfortunately, the current elites in the West unfortunately have trivialized nuclear weapons, in my opinion. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, it is delusory again, but very, very dangerous. You might have seen that the group that I nominated, Neon Adankyo, won the Nobel Peace Prize. That's the atomic bomb survivors. And I'll be going to Oslo with them in December. And they are the conscience of the world in their opposition to nuclear weapons and the need for nuclear abolition. And so for Zelensky to be threatening now, saying either let us into NATO or we're going to develop nuclear weapons, is just shows, it's partly a sign of his desperation, but it also shows his instability at this point. I mean, he's in a desperate position. The latest report that just came out shows that Ukraine has lost 10 million people. When in 1991, they had 51 million population. Before the Russian invasion, they had 40 million. Now they're down to 30 million. And my sources say that that's even an exaggerated figure. So, and they're in desperate straits.
Well, and Peter, also, maybe we're citing the same reports, but a plurality of Ukrainians in Europe have no intention of going back to Ukraine, no matter what happens.
And Russia has also lost a lot of people during this time who have fled Russia. But the situation on the Eastern Front is pretty desperate. Their attempted invasion in Kursk has backfired at this point. So the reports every day, the New York Times had a piece on October 20th about Ukrainian troops deserting.
Yep.
Because they're exhausted. They've been fighting for a long time. Where there's no respite, there's no relief, no replacements. And so they're in an increasingly desperate situation. I hope Angelo is right and that the focus turns elsewhere. But desperate countries do desperate things.
Yeah, but Matthew, let me turn to you because we're rapidly running out of time in this block here. Is that, you know, when people are in a desperate situation, they do desperate things. That's what I disagree with Angela. I think this is still a very extremely dangerous situation because NATO is facing a strategic loss. It doesn't like that idea, Matthew.
I think that's true, but there's also maybe another factor in terms of. There's a certain way that the United States, I believe, looks at the conflict where it has an advantage for it to just sort of status quo continue on.
Right.
As long as the United States has two things, there are two major priorities for America in this conflict is one, there shall be no American boots on the ground in Ukraine fighting Russians for Ukrainians. That's not going to happen. And to what Peter just mentioned, we must guarantee in some way, shape or form that no party in this conflict escalates the conflict to using nuclear weapons. So if there are no American troops on the ground in Ukraine and there's no involvement of nuclear weapons, there are many ways in which the continuation of the conflict is advantageous to the strategic interests of the United States. And that can be a very powerful factor for it to keep going.
And Angela, it's still not it's not impossible that this could spread. I mean, we've seen reports that Ukraine wants to pull Belarus in. We have a lot of social unrest in Moldova. So, I mean, it's a very unstable region. Go ahead, in Bangkok.
Well, absolutely. It's about destabilization. Ultimately, when you look at the original plan, if you look at the RAND Corporation 2019 report, it was about the title was extending Russia. Well, ultimately, they might not win, but they want to inflict as much damage as possible to Russia. We see the result. The result is not positive. Actually, you see Russia being much stronger, and the big changes in terms of world geopolitics. Russia is not isolated. On the contrary, now we see the collective West more and more isolated.
Well, it's absolutely true, and because as we speak right now, the BRICS summit is going on, and it's really interesting, and I think all of us here reflect upon this. There's not a lot of Western coverage of what's going on in Kazan right now. Matthew, you want to field that real quick, 1 minute before we go to the break?
I think that's been almost a 20-year, if not longer, mistake by the West. That's always sort of looked at BRICS as a quote-unquote pseudo or a false or quasi-international organization and not wanting to recognize its growing importance and its growing influence. And that's only increased exponentially in the last half dozen to a dozen years.
Yeah, and Matthew, one of the big things on the agenda is dealing with the politicization of the dollar and wanting to come up with an alternative system. You know, Russia is out of the Swiss system, and it has made life uncomfortable, but it not intolerable also. Matthew, what's the importance of de-dollarization, real quick?
I've written on this, actually, and it was a long time ago, but it's maintained its importance over the last 15 years in the sense that the American sort of national security ability to project power is severely hindered if we can actually create an alternative system to the.
All right, Matthew, I'm sorry. I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break, gentlemen, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelle. Remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Peter, it's already been mentioned on this program, and I think we should explore it. We're talking, we're using the words delusional when it comes to the former Ukrainian President Zelensky. But he's really kind of at the center of all this. There is kind of a way forward, and the U.S. does it all the time, is regime change. What are the possibilities of that happening? Because we do know that any kind of concessions to end this conflict, which Russia has made it very clear what its negotiating stance is, which is unacceptable to a lot of people that are supporting Zelensky and these kind of neo-Nazi, neo-fascist types, Azov and all these, they have a proverbial gun to Zelensky's head. So he's stuck. But regime change is a possibility to move forward. And I'm not saying violent. Okay, I want to make that clear to everyone. Peter.
Well, you have to be careful with regime change.
The law of unintended consequences. Yeah, I know.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
It doesn't turn out, usually doesn't turn out the way you want it. In fact, it's actually Kamala Harris's main foreign policy advisor who wrote a book about regime change and said in the Middle East and said it never turns out the way you want it to and is actually strongly opposed to it. So Zelensky's in a very difficult position, and he's been in a difficult position. He got elected largely on the basis of creating peace with Russia. And then the threats started to come in against him from the right wing in Ukraine, death threats and other assassination threats. And, you know, he's been in a very difficult position because Ukrainian society is quite divided. And now Ukraine is also demoralized. The economy is in tatters. They've lost, 1.5 million or so possible casualties. We don't know the exact number, but a young generation, you know, we saw what happened with France in World War I. when 50% of the young people between the age of 18 and 30 of young men were killed. You know, Ukraine, what kind of a future does it have at this point? So, of course, it's desperate in calling for aid from the West. But even the West has gotten very weary of aiding Ukraine. There's no appetite. So it's possible that regardless of who gets elected, that we're going to see a move toward negotiations, diplomacy, and peace after this election. And that's what we're hoping for. I wish it could happen today.
Yeah.
But hopefully it's imminent.
I mean, there's one possibility. I'm not putting much hope into it, Matthew, is that after the election, this was Biden's war, and Biden is going, okay? That's one way out. But that, you know, it's a huge grift. I mean, there's so many people in the U.S., arms manufacturers and others, making so much money off of this grift. I don't see them giving it up easily, Matthew.
It would be difficult because what I mentioned before is the fact that as long as there isn't direct physical harm or sacrifice on the American side, it's a huge economic boom, this conflict, in terms of the American military-industrial complex, because it services both sides of both equipping Ukraine, but then having to restock its reserves for American national defense. So it win-wins on both angles with the United States Congress in terms of appropriations. And that's a hard nut to crack in terms of whoever's in the White House. That's going to be a very powerful lobby that they're going to have to be dealing with.
Yeah, and Angela, even though Trump says he can, you know, he needs 24 hours or a weekend or, you know, maybe a long lunch with his advisor, I don't know. I don't put much stock into it. I think it's all political talk. It's all campaign talk here. But, you know, if you look at, there's another angle that's very important, and that is Europe. And I think that something that all of you on this program have spoken to me about is, you know, Europe's stance on all of this, because that's one of the biggest disappointments. You know, Europe is certainly very tired of this conflict, but its elites aren't. Go ahead, in Bangkok.
Well, when you look at the elites, and the elites have all been co-opted by the U.S. and by the globalist elites. You need to keep in mind that most leaders in Europe are going to a vetting system, done by the Bilderberg Group. And if you look at the origin of the European project, Jean Monnet, Walter Hallstein, they were CIA agents. They are the figures, the founders of Europe. In reality, it was never a European project. It was not for Europe. It was actually a tool to destroy nation state and to control Europe from the U.S. So in reality, you see, now it is actually becoming more and more obvious the EU, this entity is not working for the interest of Europe, but it is actually a 52nd state of the U.S. And it's disposable. The U.S. is willing to destroy Europe in order to maintain its hegemony.
You know, Peter, it's very interesting. I think John Mearsheimer, I guess it's almost a year ago, he wrote a very interesting piece, obviously predicting that Russia would prevail in this conflict. I think he called it an ugly victory. Russia would achieve an ugly victory. I think there's a lot into that. I would add to it, but there would be a miserable peace as well, that the two sides of the same coin. What do you think? You know, because when it's over, it's not really over, okay? I mean, the Ukraine will remain as a nation state. It will be truncated. But there still will be elements that the U.S. has backed that will be there and will want revenge. I mean, when it's over, it's not really over. Peter.
Well, and that's partly why Russia can't even think about taking all of Ukraine.
Yeah, right.
Because the thought of occupying a hostile country,
no.
You know how many troops Russia would need to do that? Russia's ambitions are quite limited at this point. Yeah, and I agree with what Angela was saying before, that the U.S. has different priorities. That the U.S. has been talking about the Asia pivot for more than a decade now and keeps getting distracted. But there's a reason why the U.S. officials talk about China as being the pacing threat. Biden came to office with 18 top advisors from the Center for New American Security. These are the China hawks. Rand wrote a report talking about avoiding a long war was the title, because they didn't want to get bogged down in Ukraine. And now they've gotten not only bogged down with Ukraine, but also in the Middle East. You know, so the problem is we're on the doorstep of World War III and nuclear war in three separate regions right now. What I've been calling for in my interviews around the world is that we need an emergency global summit. We need the leaders to get together and figure out a way to walk us back off the ledge, because we're at a desperate moment in history. We've never been in a situation like this. And you know, all the leaders are talking about their own parochial national interests. We need somebody to speak for the planet right now. And it's not happening. And you know, there's so much that could be done in terms of the appeal from Nihon Hidankyo for global nuclear abolition, in terms of the world population. We see, for example, with the BRICS summit that's taking place now. You asked, Angelo, about Europe. Well, right now, the Europe accounts for, or the G7 accounts for 30% of the global GDP. By the end of the decade, it's going down to 28%. The BRICS, by the end of the decade, will account for 37%. And that doesn't even include all the countries that are lining up to join them. So we're at a moment of global realignment, and we can make this something positive. You know, the Chinese talk about win-win diplomacy. You mentioned win-win also before. We have to be thinking about that rather than this zero-sum game that we're playing now, because it's getting us just deeper and deeper into a crisis with horrific possible consequences.
Peter, I there's so much there that I agree with you, but I think it may be a bridge too far. Matthew, a lot of people, particularly you know, the Washington elites and foreign policy, they think things are going just swimmingly, okay? Because what my point is here, you know, well, if we can't win, we're going to make sure the other side doesn't win. We'll always create chaos around, you know, chaos for the Russians, chaos for the Chinese. Chaos is a good enough alternative to winning. Go ahead, Matthew.
I think that's true, but it's also, people have to remember that the United States has always been really, really adept at sort of pushing false narratives onto other countries.
Yep.
So suddenly, I have always posited Russia's real goal in this conflict was never about occupying Ukraine or moving onward to Eastern and Central Europe. It was rather a very definitive and almost pragmatic plea saying, we will not allow anyone to isolate us in our own neighborhood. We will not allow adversaries to be right on our doorstep with ill intention. And as long as people understand that we will remain a global power and we will remain strong on the global stage, that's our goal. That's our only intent. And that's sort of depressing for both the United States and Europe, because I think the United States for sure thought, well, we probably can't make Ukraine win this war, but if it endlessly goes on and grinds Russia down, that's almost maybe even better than ending war.
That's it. That's the plan B. You're absolutely right. Angela, we're almost out of time here, but in my introduction, I talked about peace and security, and that is actually a tangent to what Peter was talking about in Washington. We need a global summit to talk about peace and security for all, the indivisibility of peace and security for all. That's a winner. Donald Trump, you could get a Nobel Prize for this. Go ahead, Angela, before we finish.
Well, I think we need to look at this new philosophy of the multipolar world. It is about going back to sovereign state, own interest. And as the Chinese say, they say, look for what unites us and set aside the differences. You see how more adults they are. And actually, when you look at how the speeches done by BRICS, it's not about seeking conflict and dividing. It's about, you want to work with us? Let's trade together. We have differences. Well, let's leave the status quo and put that aside. And those are adults. And hopefully we have adults back on the table. But right now, we have some elites that are not working for their own people, and they are desperate because they want to hold on to power. And that's why we're in this position.
Okay, gentlemen, we started out very depressing, but I think we ended on a note of optimism. I think I was a skeptic about BRICS for a very long time. I've changed my mind. I think this win-win approach is the only way forward right now for all of humanity. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. I want to thank my guests in Bangkok and in Washington, and of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.